Hey everyone, welcome to the Rice People Podcast. On this show, we talk to the innovators, creators, and thinkers doing some of the most interesting things in Asia. I'm Adil, and this is Wong Lei.
We dive into their journeys, learn how they think, and cover why they're doing what they're doing. We hope to provide you the inspiration and insights you need to forge your own journey. You can access all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources to keep learning at ricepeoplepodcast.com.
Our guest this week is Justine Nguyen. Justine is a product designer, UI developer, and an avid writer. She worked as a designer in multiple agencies and tech companies in the Philippines before moving to Canada to work at Shopify. She also writes about her design processes and shares all her learnings on Medium. This was such a fun chat where we talked about why she decided to move to Canada, her personal principles of good design, how designers have a responsibility for considering edge cases in their work, her views on imposter syndrome, how she self-trained to become a designer, and so much, much more. We hope you'll enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Now on to our conversation with Justine.
Hi, thanks for having me here and thanks for the invite and staying up late just to do this interview with me. Really appreciate it.
Can you share a little bit more about where you are right now and your work at Shopify? Like, what's your role and what do you do and what's your day-to-day like?
Yeah, so I'm a product designer and in the past, I am a UI developer. I still code a bit of UI, but it's not really like part of my day-to-day job. It's like more like I was doing it before and now I'm just like trying to maintain my website. So I still do a bit of UI development. So product design is, as its name suggests, is designing about the product. I would say that some people are calling it UX, UI designer, and that could probably be the same, depends on if you want to argue about it or not. But really what we're thinking about, what we're really thinking about product design is about the product experience of the user. It might encompass UX and UI. You might be thinking about the technicalities of things. You might be thinking about internationalization, accessibility, thinking about the product area itself. So for example, if you are UX, UI, you don't really question the problem space, or if you're given a problem, you just get to solutioning or like thinking about ways to tackle this problem. But I think if you're a product designer, you're thinking way beyond UX and UI. You're thinking about the entire product that you are working on and how it would affect this different parts of that product. And I'm saying this because I was working in an agency before, and we usually work on brochure websites and projects that are one-off. Like once you release them, you never see them again. you never get to iterate on them. You're like, you just pray and hope that they're gonna work with your users. And which led me to like, okay, the next step that I wanna do is to actually work on a product company. And when you're working in a product company, you have like one baby product or like a big product which you are a part of in a specific area. And you're kind of like iterating it. You have the opportunity to iterate that product. And so that's why I moved here in Canada. And that's really what I wanted for myself. And because I'm sharing a lot of things online, I feel like in the Philippines, I was kind of limited. When you're at the point where you feel like you are the smartest person in the room and you can no longer learn from your colleagues, or you need to reach out somewhere in order to continue your growth, that's where you know you're in the wrong place and you probably need to move on to somewhere else. And that's kind of like what sparked my interest with moving outside, because at least in the Philippines, I could only talk with, even in the realms of the Philippines, you're still fighting for the value of design. Like, why should we hire designers? Why are we doing design? Like, you're still fighting for that. And that's like a fight that I've been fighting all like 4 years in the Philippines. When I left, like that's where a lot of the industries, especially in Asia, are starting to like realize the value of design, because you see a lot of products. They're all like the same. They're offering the same, like social media. They're all the same, but they kind of the main difference is the experience and the value that they bring to the user. And so, sorry if I'm blabbering, but
no, that's what we like.
But when I realized that, holy shit, I'm not learning. Like, why am I answering these questions about the pixels and like the alignment? Like, this is not what I want to solve for. Like, I want to go deep into the problem space and have peers who challenges my thinking. And so I'm like, I think I need to move somewhere where there is a mature design process and a lot of experts within your peers, and learn from them. And hopefully I could give them back, or like teach them back to my colleagues back in the Philippines or in Asia.
Oh, that's amazing to hear. Actually, I'm just super curious, like maybe if you can share, like within Shopify, like which area of product are you working on? Like, is it on the merchant side or the lending side? Or I know that Shopify is like a wide company, right?
Yeah, it's a huge company. Like when I first joined, I was part of the account settings part of Shopify. But later on, we moved to a space. COVID happened, and so we have to reshuffle internally. And I work on a project that's more geared towards solving a problem related to COVID. But it didn't work out because we thought that it would be a quick win. But then people started, like, COVID was on and off, the lockdown was on and off. Mm-hmm. And then we realized that if you want to work on this project, which I cannot really like dive into.
Yeah.
But we realized that it's no longer a quick win because it will take a lot of effort to work on it the entire year or even more. And so that's when I started to, the team kind of was dismantled, and then we were moved to different teams, and I landed on draft orders, which is a part of Shopify that allows the merchant to create an order in behalf of their buyer.
Oh.
And what I learned from this is that you will think probably that if you are in Shopify and if you move in a different team within Shopify, you'll have all the contacts you need to just continue to be better at your job. But when I moved to draft orders, or like the part that I'm now, I'm like, holy crap, like there's so many contacts that I don't know, and it's like starting from zero again.
Wow.
Because you have a different sort of user. Like, for example, if you're working on the admin, you're focused on different users. If you're working on a specific part of the admin, sometimes you also find yourself dealing with different users because this is only the type of user that uses this part of your product. And so it's like there's so many things to learn, and like you always switch. When you switch teams, you also switch contacts and you have to learn again.
Yeah. But that's part of the fun also, right? Like, I guess you can just move around within the same company and continue learning a lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe just to zoom out a little bit, this is probably a bit of a broad question, but considering you have, I guess, quite a number of years of design experience under your belt, I was wondering, like, as someone who's had some experience building products in different industries and agencies, like, what is your own personal philosophy on building well-designed products, right? Generally speaking, right?
Okay, that's a good question. Like, I think for me, I am always a firm believer of if you're presented with a problem, you don't start answering that problem right away. I think as designers, we have the opportunity to really influence product in a sense where you can challenge the problem that you're solving. Like, for example, it's easy to just create a, like, it's easy to like solve something like, hey, for example, hey, let's, there's a lot of blue collar jobs or like a lot of opportunities for people working in the service space. And probably we could create like an app for them that would help them find jobs. And then usually as a designer, you would just, okay, this is the problem. Let's create the best experience for these users. But you should be, as a product designer, my philosophy is, okay, this is the problem. Is this really a problem worth solving? And let's investigate if this is the reality. Like, do we assume that all these users have access to mobile or a computer if you're trying to create an experience on a computer? Like, you have to be realistic first. Like, okay, this is a nice problem, but is this a problem worth our time? And what you can do is like research on your users, find out what their problems and needs are, and whether you're solving the right problem, or maybe you need to shape or change like how you ask the problem. And then once you know that you are, okay, this is a real problem, we should definitely spend our time here. This is when you kind of start getting context first on that problem space. Okay, if you're working on an app that is hoping to connect you with different opportunities, you should know first, okay, who are our target users? What are they experiencing day to day? And what are existing out there already that is not solving their problem? Like for sure, in this digital age, there's so many ideas out there, but why is it still a problem, right? And then you kind of look for opportunities where you could bring value to the users. And once you have those like, okay, this is the value that we're bringing, this is the problems that we're solving, and this is probably the things that we should focus on. And once you have all those problem or context about the problem, and then you go meet experts and talk to users, that's when you start ideating actually. And sometimes this is like the mistake of designers. They ideate and then they check. The first check happens after they ideate and solution. But But that's not how it works. You should actually ask the users at the very first part of your process. And then based on what you know about them, that's when you start solutionizing or ideating, and then you present it to them. And then based on their feedback, you iterate. And then you get to like a series of iterations and also stakeholders meeting. Like people don't talk about like the internal stuff, but you're also like trying to present your case to stakeholders inside the company. It's not like if it's, it's not like one solution where if it works for your users, great, you bring it to your stakeholders, they're sold. No, usually you also like have to convince your stakeholders that this is the right thing to do, because some of them also have context on this, also have expertise on this product area. Like they work probably in a previous company. They probably have a different background. And so you have to like also present your case and convince them that, okay, this is the problem, this is what we learned. And you kind of just make compromises along the way. Usually, it's not perfect. You have a very perfect idea of the solution, but once you go through a series of feedback and stakeholders meeting, your solution evolves. And as a designer and as a team as well, you have to make the proper compromises, because at the end of the day, the final product doesn't really look exactly like your best solution. Usually, you cut off things, you add things, you change things, and that's okay. That's okay.
I think in that question you like answered like the three following questions that I had for you, but really a lot of things there struck a chord with me, because my girlfriend is also a UI UX designer at in a London company, and she always scolds me, right, because I always have a lot of business ideas as well, and I go straight into what she always says, stop solutionizing or solutioning or something like that, and because I just want to immediately go into solving the problem and not really questioning, as you mentioned, like questioning the question itself, whether it is the right question you should be asking. Then maybe I'll just touch on the last part of the things we are talking about, which is more on the people side of the design role, right? Like it's something that I guess it's not commonly talked about, but there's a decent amount of interaction with both stakeholders and customers. And I'm sure you've had experiences where you've had to convince stakeholders on your idea, your concept, and sometimes they are not convinced by your proposal, right? So in this, maybe you can talk about that experience in itself. And then also, what have you found to be the most effective way to get like stakeholder buy-in, in terms of your own experience?
Wow, damn. That's a $1 million question for a lot of designers, to be honest. So I could speak to my experience from the Philippines and how it's somewhat different in Shopify. So when I was in the Philippines, I started my journey in a startup company. And there wasn't, it's an agency as well. And from what I recall, we don't have a concept of UX managers. You usually have like a chief design. In my first company, we have like a chief design officer, and then we have a bunch of ICs. There's no really like a middle management. Like everything's somewhat direct and flat, I think. And really your boss is the stakeholder, because in an agency, they present you with a project brief. And then back then, 5 years ago, in an agency world, they present you with a problem. You come up with different stylescapes,
mm-hmm.
or like mood boards. You start with mood boards right away, and then they choose like they choose which one they prefer. It's very what you call this in the surface almost. Like they're just like looking at on the UI, and then if
visual
they feel like,
design.
Yeah, they're basing it on visual, like the impression and the visuals, and then once they're okay with it, you just start creating those interactions or there's those mock-ups, and then basically they just like talk about those screens. And in my experience, a lot of them don't really, I guess because we were hired for making the design, not a lot of the stakeholders in the first company was asking us the why and the how. They're more like, oh, I want this pink, I want this button red. Just the way they give feedback is also very UI, because that's only the thing that they probably know about, like judging the outer surface of your design. And usually you just leave it up to your project manager to sell your idea, or I guess that's their job, like make sure that their stakeholders are happy, make them laugh probably, and then convince them that this is a good solution. Sometimes they come back with you, but it's always about the UI and not like less about the UX. And that's the frustrating part. Like I feel like for me, it didn't frustrate me because of the UX. It's because like after you ship the product, you don't really know what happens afterwards if your solution works. And usually they don't have a budget for Q&A or research. Like it's not usually a part of their budget to conduct usability tests. And so it depends on you as a designer if you want to spend more time on this outside of your work hours, or sometimes you have to compromise, right? Like I found myself a lot in those back in the days 5 years ago, like just shipping things and hustling and not understanding the value of my work. And it frustrated me because when it went to like me writing down case studies, I don't know what to write about. I don't know the impact of my work. And so that's when you don't know the outcome of your work. And so I'm like, okay, I'm not being challenged. I'm not really learning anything. I'm not confident if my solution really worked. So what could I do? That's when I started like reading online. Medium.com was a huge thing before. Back before, it was less about marketing stuff. It was really like a place where people can learn about things. And like, it's amazing how designers across the globe writes about this stuff, and then you get to learn from them.
Yeah.
That's when I started reading about it, and I realized like, holy shit, there's a lot of things about design that I don't know about. Like I don't know about card sorting. I didn't know about like terminology, like mental models. Like I haven't heard about it. How come I didn't know about these things? And so I'm like, okay, what are they talking about? And how is it different with my current process? And then that's what I learned about UX, and not everything is just UI. Like I'm fascinated about the design process where it involves UX and really thinking deeply about your users and empathizing with them. And that's when I started like proposing to my team, like, hey, I heard about UX and I heard about all these processes before even crafting the mockup. Can we try doing this? And I'm willing to be the guinea pig for in our agency. And so they're like, okay, because they trust me a lot in my company, usually I make great decisions. So they're like, okay, we're gonna try it with our new client, and I'm gonna give the client to you. You're gonna spearhead this project. And that's when I remember it was the first time when a client came in and we actually ideated together.
Wow.
And learn about the problem. Like usually they give you the project brief and then bye-bye, come see me after 2 weeks and present me with ideas. But no, in that meeting, it was different. Like I remember he went to the office, I grabbed some papers, and we're like, okay, tell me about your company, tell me about your problem, tell me about your users. And soon after, like, we find ourselves just like sketching ideas and me telling him just in the form of paper why probably this isn't working and why this is working. And so he was already part of that ideation process. And you kind of already like were agreeing to some certain aspects of the product or the design. And so when we went to say our goodbyes and when I said him, told him like what are the next steps are, when he came back and I showed him the solutions, he didn't question a lot of it because he knew the earlier part of the process. And he was part of it. The agreement already happened even before the during the ideation, even before you showing them. So I think that's a lot of, like, I learned the magic of incorporating stakeholders in the ideation process and how it really really benefits you to like put them on your side. Without it, it's really hard to like give them all the context and put them on board. And then from there, like, we just continue doing that. Like, we found ourselves collaborating with our stakeholders in the earlier part of the process, and it became like an easy job for me.
Oh, that must be such a paradigm shift in working with your stakeholders. Like, you're really building based on trust and the relationship, and you keep on strengthening that. I think whatever you develop would be a lot more creative, a lot more effective too.
Exactly, yeah. You really want to build that confidence and trust with your stakeholders at the beginning.
Yeah. Just now, you also mentioned that in the design process, as you iterate, you involve your stakeholders and your users and you get feedback. And sometimes you have to reach compromises. And a lot of those compromises can be good compromises. So what would you define as like a good compromise? And what would you define as something that is a compromise that you wouldn't want to make?
Right. Like, so it all comes back to the user experience, right? Like, if you remove something or if you add something, will it hinder them from doing achieving that user goal that you have? It's okay. It probably will. If it's okay if it's going to add more steps or something, but if it stops them from achieving their end goal in that certain part of the of your product space, then you know that it's not a good compromise. You really have to think about through your user's lens if it's going to entirely block them. And if not, probably you could come up with different like solution. Because I know there's a lot of limitations, right? Like, there are times where you can't really like design the best experience, for example, because there's no time to build it, or the backend is structured in a different way, and it's not just like, it's not magically it's impossible unless you rebuild the entire system. And that's where what, and also like, okay, before you even like compromise, you have to make sure that you're covering all the right places in a sense where, okay, I know about the technical limitations, what else don't I know about? Because sometimes you just make one decision based on one limitation, and you forgot that, okay, it works for this limitation, but it doesn't work in other contexts. So you have to understand first, what does it cover? If I'm going to make this compromise, what does it cover? Does it cover the product, the business, the user, the technicality of things? And will it work for other of those areas? Maybe you're just calling the shots for the sake of an easier implementation, but actually it also affects other parts of your company, like accessibility, internationalization, things like that, like are also come to play. For me, like, a good compromise is something that's makes it easier for your team probably to implement it, and also helps your user to get the value right away, because sometimes you compromise, but it also extends the time of development. And your user can't really use your product until a certain time. But there are times where the compromise also comes from the user, where they have to use this product right away because their business needs it. And so what you can do is like assess, okay, will this make our job easier as a product people? And will this also at least not burden the user, but also still help them to reach their goal? If it's hindering your product, your business, and your users all at the same time, then it's not a good compromise.
I love this conversation. Like, I always hear every stakeholder's name is well represented in this conversation. Like, I hear user, company, business, like everyone is well represented. Yeah. Yeah, actually, I wanted to maybe zoom out a bit and maybe bring this conversation to a bit of a maybe something that I just thought was interesting and was a bit in the news maybe like over the last couple of months, which was about design and I guess what you could call morality. Like maybe bring back to the most common case of this example would be like Robin Hood in the United States, right? Like there was that whole hoo-ha of like before that entire incident, you know, people were like Robin Hood was like, I guess, looked up to as like a very well done user experience, like onboarding was smooth, everyone had people felt joy from using the product and these kinds of things. But suddenly when users were experiencing bad outcomes, which may not be, I guess, part of the product's fault, but it could also be, but also because it's investing, right, there's an element of a user will experience losses and stuff like that. But how do you think about that in terms of like, would making something so easy and good to use lead to like bad outcomes? And how do I think about that versus and like handholding, guardrails versus easy to use user experience? Yeah, I'm not sure if I phrased that well, but I'm sure you get the gist of it. Yeah.
Are you talking about the Robin Hood incidents where one young guy end up spending a lot and taking his life?
Because he was trading options then, but the UI didn't show that. It was showing like negative $700,000, but then because it was options, it's a more complicated product, the UI didn't show like you don't actually owe this money, and then he went to take his own life.
I remember that news and it really broke my heart because it's one of those problems where if only the interface was designed to be more clear and helpful, I think. And sometimes in design, you also introduce frictions these frictions probably would add more step or something, but it makes sure that your users doesn't commit user errors that are very critical and risky. And in the case of Robinhood, I didn't see their UI, but this is like the responsibility of designers in making sure that you cover all the edge cases and all of these very extreme cases where probably people do something with your product and it results to something. And how does that appear? Like, it's very easy to design about like the happy path, like probably if they're earning a lot of money, how does that look like? How do we make them feel good about their earnings? But you also have to cover like the opposite side of it, the most extreme negative side of it. Like if they have negative in their account, how do we display that? And how do we help them, even though if they're experiencing this negative experience, like how do we aid that to make it to alleviate a lot of the pain? One example of this is that sometimes when you think of success banners, for example, we always assume that they have their 10th order or something, and we have to celebrate it with our user because this is a good milestone for them. But not all users feel the same way when they have 10 orders. Probably they've been doing this for 10 years now, and in those 10 years they only had 10 orders. And so you have to empathize with this type of user, right?
Like, that's a good point.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh my god,
yeah,
it's a good example.
Like for Robinhood, they missed that opportunity of providing value and helping the user when in times of need. And I think this is one thing that I always design for when I design products is like, how does this scale? Like, how does this look like in the good times and in the bad times? Like if you're building, for example, I'm in draft orders where the merchant can create an order for the buyer. It's easy to look at the lens of D2C where usually the buyer places like 10 orders. You can easily design how that data table looks like because with this amount of information. But there's the other edge cases where a lot of our merchants create B2B orders that could be hundreds or thousands of orders. And once you have like 1,000 rows, is it still pleasant to use? Can you still make sense of the information?
Yeah.
Or does it become harder to understand what's in the UI or how they read information? And so when you're designing, you always think about the best use cases and the worst use cases and make sure that you are, whatever you build works for both of those use cases and they are actually scalable and they hit the sweet spot. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I also like that phrase used, like adding intentional friction to the process, right? When there's very critical outcomes that could occur from that user interaction. Yeah, yeah.
Building on this discussion, I just borrowed this book about the future of feelings. I think like technology really makes it easy for people to connect. It's like here we are connecting through a call. But it also makes it very easy for you to block someone. Like on Twitter, you can just block someone if they are like trolling you. On Facebook, you can just block people that you don't agree with. Then what's your take on designing for empathy? Not just designing with empathy.
For empathy. I think a lot of it is removing yourself from the product or the thing you're designing for and really putting your shoes yourself in the merchant's shoes or in the user's shoes and really thinking what do they feel if they're using your product. Like, I think that's it's a no-brainer, but it's also like the hardest thing to do is to remove yourself from the picture and thinking from the lens of your user. Like, and a lot of it is, if you want to get better into this, is like try becoming that user. Or at least try experiencing what they're experiencing. So, for example, at Shopify, a lot of people are encouraging people to create your own store and start your own business because this is the best way for you to learn the ins and outs of the pains and the success and all the experiences of your merchants. And if you have all those like experiences, you'll be able to understand really deeply what probably they care about. Like for me, it sounds difficult, and I think it still is difficult, but because there are parts in the design process where you kind of forget about them. You think of them in the ideation part, and then when you're iterating, because there's so many conversations happening, and this is real. Sometimes you talk to your stakeholders, to your peers, and sometimes you get influence about how they think and you tend to forget about your users. Like, you always have to come back, okay, who am I advocating for? Is it am I advocating for devs or am I advocating for our users? And once you remind yourself of the reason why you're building this and who are your users, then you'll be able to build or design for empathy. And it's a constant journey. It's not like you try to become them or you talk to them at the beginning. You also come up with a solution and you bring it back to your users and get their feedback. Like it's in a perfect world, you become the user and you know the ins and outs, but also like there's a lot of limitation and realistically speaking, I can't make my own business. Like, does it mean that I have to create my own business in order to design for Shopify? Like, no. But a lot
you
of it is just...
You can end up with your own D2C brand.
Yeah. A lot of it is just really like having conversations with your users. Like, that's the easiest way. Like, make sure that they are part of the conversation and you get real feedback from real users.
Yeah. I actually really enjoyed using... I used Shopify to create a store over a weekend. I think it was really very user-friendly because I did manage to build up my shop front using Shopify. I set up the entire process just within like 2 days. So I think it's a really amazing platform. Yeah. And I think that must be a lot of design work that we don't see. And I think sometimes with design also, it's a lot of things that you don't put in that really makes a big difference, not just the things that you see on the platform. Yeah. Actually, do you have experiences or examples that you can share about the designs that were not implemented on the products that you were building?
What
was the thought process behind it? Yeah.
Like why it was removed from the actual solution or like how we Can you elaborate more on your question?
Yeah, sure. So were there situations where there were some features that were suggested that were really considered to be implemented, but in the end, the team or the company decided that, okay, this is not a feature that we want to implement.
And right.
Like, is there any like design thought behind it or any like process that goes behind this kind of design decisions?
I think the one that came up to mind is the project that was canceled during a project that's related to COVID, but we decided to pause. And I think like in hindsight, like I thought like when it happened, like I thought, okay, this is like a huge, it was saddening, and you know, because you work on it for like 3 months and 6 months. But in hindsight, I realized that design really played a huge part of it, because without our explorations on the solutions, we won't be able to uncover the size of this project. Like, if you were just to think about it in your head, like, okay, this is easy, like we could just implement this and then that would be a quick win for us. But once we started working on design and really thinking about different paths that the user should take and different touch points in the admin that would be affected by this this feature, we realized soon enough that, okay, this is a huge undertaking and it's actually a more complicated change in the UI as well. And it would cause our users to learn something new that's like, it's not a small difference or improvement anymore, but rather a huge change. And so design really played a part of us understanding the scope of the work and the possible changes that goes along with it. And that's when we decided, okay, this is a problem, but if we introduce this to our merchants, it wouldn't make a huge, like we're putting so much effort into something that can still work to this day. They could somehow still hack the admin to work it for this use case, and it's not worth it. And that's where that's one of the things that it's not even just a part of the product. We scratch out the entire product because we realized that like if
it
we were
very painful.
Yeah, like if you think of it, like in for example in the interface, you're just adding one radio button, because this allows users to do this X and Y. But this would require a lot of changes in the admin, not just in your product area, but across the system. And is it worth it? Because at the end of the day, merchants or users can still find a different way to do this without that radio button. And if it's not blocking them, that's okay. That's a good compromise. We shouldn't be building this product. We should move on somewhere else that requires our energy.
Yeah. I think it's also like you're putting your ego, the team's ego, or the designer's ego below the user's need and their benefit. Yeah, I think that's really quite powerful.
And I think it's very important that at the end of, even if it's a project pause or something that's crashed, you always have, as a designer and as a product R&D or something, you have to make sure that you are reflecting on them and doing a retrospective on things that went wrong and probably what's the best way to handle if ever certain problem or similar problem arises, so that you know already the early signals of why, if it's heading in the wrong direction or in the good direction. I think that's one thing that I learned, is that we waited until we got a clear picture of the UX before flagging this as something risky. But if we were able to kind of predict some signs or tripwires for us to like know, okay, this is going in the wrong direction, probably we'll save each other's time, like 2 weeks left, less or 1 month less. But you also hear people saying, no, this is the right time. Like, that's the perfect time. 3 months, we realize the scope of the problem, and then, no, we're not working on this. And that's a luxury of working in a product company. In startup, no, not a chance. Yeah. 3 months, you'll have to have the MVP right away.
Yeah. I totally feel the pain. I used to work in product design, physical product design in medical company also. Then I think I work on the product, especially for physical products, the timelines are like a year, right? And then your product, the company decides not to launch it, you know, not to trouble the users or make them learn something new. And then it goes down the drain. And yeah, it's like, I mean, at the first few days after that, you know, it's like a stab to your heart, right? Like all your hard-earned, hard effort and everything. But But eventually, you know, you come to realize, yeah, it's for the company and for the users, etc. Yeah. And I guess let's rewind the timeline back a bit to a little bit of your history, Justine, where I guess looking at your history, I think in university you studied web development, I think,
I took up IT, information technology.
IT, yeah. And yeah, so I'm just curious, like, you know, how did you even get into the UI UX product design space, yeah, in the first place? Yeah, especially considering back in those days, the available resources online were not as vast as it is today, right?
Yeah. To be honest with you, I didn't learn anything about design in school. Like, it's design wasn't a thing 5 years ago, especially in the Philippines. Like, it was unknown. I think the only thing that's designed to me was like graphic designs of tarpaulin and posters. That's the only thing that I know about design. And I think my fascination with design started when I was a kid. Like, I wanted to be, I like playing games a lot. Like, I love playing Mario and Red Alert and Counter-Strike.
Love it.
A lot of like OG games, and I thought, okay, I love playing. I want to become game developer. But at the same time, back in the day, a lot of people wanted to work abroad. And for us to work abroad, you have to become a nurse. So the nurse was a hot booming industry 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of my classmates wanted to get to nursing because that would help them go to America or somewhere or move abroad. I remember myself subscribing to that belief that I do want to become a nurse. And so in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm just playing games as a hobby. And then, but I really wanted to become a nurse. I was finding ways to like convince myself that I'm good as a nurse. I remember I was like, oh, I fold the beds the nice way, or like this very like superficial belief about nurse, and like I'm very caring, so maybe I'm gonna be good as a nurse. And then everyone is just like hyping about which nursing school do you want to go to. But funny enough, this was way back in high school. Like, after I graduated in high school, I was sold into the idea I'm gonna be a nurse, and so I took up entrance exams, and then in one of the top schools for nursing in the Philippines or in our city, and I actually passed. Oh. And there were like thousands of people wanting to apply, and then I passed. But when I was like, there's a deadline, and then I went to the school and submitted my papers, and then they're like, oh, I'm sorry, all of the classes are filled, we can't take students anymore, but are you interested with IT? And I'm like, what's IT?
Wow,
I've never
fate.
Heard of this.
Wow.
And so I came back home, and then I told my Asian mom, like, mom, I don't think I can be a nurse. Trying my best.
Oh, no.
it's not
Yeah.
destiny.
Yeah.
But they mentioned something like IT. I have you heard about it? And he's like, oh, IT, I heard your uncle is IT or something. Usually they hear things if one of their relatives are working abroad, and like if they're an IT or a nurse, they would know about it. So it's like, that's not bad. And so I'm like, okay, I'm gonna look into what IT is. And then I learned about coding and how it's related to game development. I'm like, okay, probably I could be an IT, and then maybe I could develop my own game. But as soon as I entered college, I soon realized that it's way different from expectations. You're not really doing game development. You're learning about Java, Net, what they call it, Visual Basics, and all this programming stuff. And I'm like, holy shit, it's all not what I'm expecting. And there's also not a lot of creative aspects to it. Like, it's very basic. But because I was doing well, for some reason, I was doing well in college. I was skipping class. I admit, I was skipping class to play games. But surprisingly, I was doing well. And at the end of, like, I think third year or fourth year, there was this regional contest for hackathon.
Yep.
And because I was like a top honor student, they were like, okay, you're forced to do this. You have to learn this in 1 week and then participate in the contest. And I'm like, okay, I see. I see what you're doing here. So not to embarrass myself, I spent like a week before the contest to just, because they told me last minute that I'm entering the contest and we're participating. And so I have a 1 week to learn about how to code HTML and CSS.
Mm-hmm.
And I stumbled upon this channel, Dev Tips. And he was a great designer. His name is Travis Nelson. He's my design hero. Surprisingly, a lot of like developers or front-end developers actually learn from him because he was also like one of the OGs back in the days. That's where I learned about coding coding a design to HTML and CSS. And back in the days, developers were coding in tables and divs and floats, and nothing is responsive. Like I think six years ago, nothing was responsive when you shrink the screen. But back in the day, because a lot of the education in the Philippines are still from the book, like not a lot of professors are in the industry anymore, so they don't really know like what are the new hot tech. But because I learned from YouTube and I learned from someone who was in Silicon Valley, that's where I learned about SCSS or SAS, and it's not SCSS and SAS back in the day. Sorry, Flexbox. Sorry, I was pertaining to Flexbox. Yeah, yeah. So back in the day, Flexbox was something very new. Not a lot of websites are doing Flexbox, but I learned what Flexbox is. Like the first time I was coding, I knew the concept of Flexbox, and Flexbox is a way for you to like align elements in your website and how they would work in when it's responsive. Responsiveness wasn't a thing before. And so I remember when I was learning this, I was so into it because I like how things just align with just one single code. Like they know what they should do. You don't have to say like what exactly how many px from the left or the right. You just like say align vertically center or something, and then it happens magically. Like this is fascinating. I want to do this. And so I did this. I had the contest a week after, and I remember there were like 16 people. There's only like two of us, female developers at the time. There were like majority of them were men.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was coding, and then eventually we led to like the judging phase. And I couldn't forget the face, the look on the face of the judges when they were looking at my computer, because they were like trying to zoom in and zoom out. But it wasn't like behaving the same way as others, because the rest were like doing floats and tables, but mine was like Flexbox. I'm like, holy crap, what sorcery is this? And I just enjoyed the look in their face, man. I'm like, oh my god, this is so fun. I feel so proud of that time. And then eventually, like they did the scoring, and then I heard I should place third, but I eventually placed fourth in the competition. But like none of that mattered because I'm like, this is like my newfound self.
Yeah, you found your sorcery.
I found my calling. Like I really enjoy development, and I also enjoy learning about it. And so I'm like, okay, after I graduate, I'm gonna be a front-end developer, but I'm also like doing a lot of like graphics before. Like I was doing Photoshop. And so I'm like, I'll sell myself as a front-end developer / UI UX designer or something. And that's when I found my first job is with an agency, and because I sold myself as a front-end developer, my first project was actually coding design into HTML and CSS. But later on, there was a need for someone doing design because there's a lot of like client projects. We only have like few designers, and because I had background with Photoshop, that's basically the only thing like I know about Photoshop. So I tried to learn how to design, and then pretty much a lot of it was just like learning from your peers, learning from the internet.
Like I
already told this at the beginning part, everything is UI. So I didn't really have problems around UX. Like I'm not really thinking deeply about the problem space. And so I wasn't really like challenged. But I remember that was like my entry point, like just this contest, like me realizing what I wanna do. And then kind of just like faking it until you make it kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. What an amazing story. So funny. And I was also just curious, right? Since you were back in the Philippines, you worked at some agencies where you're doing multiple different projects. And yeah, I'm just quite curious. I have quite a few designer friends here in Southeast Asia as well. I'm just curious, from your point of view, what's the big differences in the experience between working in an agency versus in-house? Yeah.
There's quite a lot. And probably I'm also speaking this like because I work with one or two agencies before. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if this is accurate anymore. I'm pretty sure in Asia, like things are shifting as well. Because everything is like global now, like everything's more accessible, so yeah. Probably it's different. But I would say that the huge difference for me is really not getting the feedback that you want out of users. Like the design process, I don't think is not as different anymore. Like I feel like a lot of them probably are already like similar, because we're design itself is also like maturing and developing. And a lot of people are probably learning about different ways, like design processes. So I don't think it's relevant anymore. But I remember, and I think it's still relevant today, that in agency, it depends on their budget and their timeline, on how much effort and time you can put on in this project, and whether you could even iterate and get feedback from your users. In the Philippines, we didn't have... Our design agency wasn't that huge yet when I was there. And so usually it's just like a one-time kind of thing where you iterate and then once it's done, you ship it and then you don't really continue your relationship with your stakeholders anymore. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes when you continue to do so, it's the scope of the work is not related to UX, but more of the visual changes. And I think that's the huge difference of an agency is that you don't really iterate on the product and grow your product with you.
Isn't that a feedback loop after you submit the project?
Yeah, there's, and then I'm not sure as well, but back in the days, we don't have a lot of resources to reach out to users. Like I remember you don't even know, you didn't even like nail down on your user, your target user. And so once you get to the phase where you want to learn from there or get feedback from them, it's very hard to look for the users that you need to talk to and get feedback on, because they weren't really nailed at the beginning of the project. Unless if your target user is quite common, like a delivery app, for example, everyone can be using this product and so it's kind of okay. But in a product company, you have researchers, you have a lot of people like getting context and documenting this data. And if you need to like, okay, I want to test this because of, for these reasons, usually you have an answer already. Like you know exactly which type of users you should be talking to. And it's just a matter of booking time with them. And this is what one of the powers of product, because you own the data, you own your information, and you document your own information and you can circle back to it eventually. A lot of the agency as well, at least for me, was working on brochure sites, and a lot of them are driven by visual design. There's not, it's less about software, but more about brochure and WordPress. And so everything is kind of templated. Like you almost have like a cookie cutter kind of design. Like, you know, like how a typical homepage looks like. You just have to, you just have to incorporate brand into it, right? Like, but with product company, it's much complex. Like it's huge. It's a different caliber almost, because what works for a different company doesn't necessarily work for your company. And so you start leaning on to like existing products within your probably like competitors, and also from the research that you've done internally, and less about like what's out there and what are the patterns that we could steal. Like there's no cookie cutter anymore, and users are becoming more complex and more, like sophisticated.
I also want to ask you about your own personal learnings. You said in one podcast, I think it was Roots podcast.
Yeah.
That I think you said this one line: confidence takes a lot of practicing. I have not heard anyone put it that way before. Yeah, so can you share more about your approach to building confidence, especially when you have really tried to venture into fields that you have no prior experience? Yeah, how do you do it?
All right, so I'm gonna tell this to all the designers listening, to all creative people. Imposter syndrome never fades away. It never disappears. Like I thought before when I was a junior that if I gain more experience, I'll probably feel very confident and I wouldn't feel as shitty as before. I thought that I would be doing so well with storytelling and presenting my ideas. But the more you grow, the more you know, the less you know, kind of thing, like Aristotle, what Aristotle said, like, the more you know, the less you know, because at the point where you grow into your box, and then you begin to move on to another box, you realize that there's so many things that I don't know, and I'm almost like starting again from zero. And that's how I feel when I moved from the Philippines to Canada to work for Shopify. Mm-hmm. Like I was so confident, not super confident, but I was like, I think I know a lot of stuff now, so I'm ready to go. But when I moved to like Shopify, that's when I realized that there are still so many things that I don't know. And that's when I start feeling like, should I be here? Why did they hire me? Like, I feel like I'm not qualified to work for a product company like this in this state. And it took a lot of effort from me and working to like make sure that I have that creative confidence to still continue working. Because when you start doubting yourself and you lose belief in yourself, that's when you start losing interest in what you do, kind of thing. I'm not sure if this is relatable, but when I first started Shopify, because I was new, I didn't have the confidence. I found myself always like doubting whether I should speak up what's on my mind. Probably a lot of people in the room already knows this because they probably know a lot of context and I'm new to here. So I'm not sure whether I should say this. Maybe I sound stupid.
Oh my God, sounds so familiar.
Yeah. Like if you're the new person to the room, there's a lot of like confidence shattering moments. And I think this is one thing that I always remind myself, like after talking to a lot of senior designers and even staff designers, like these are designers working for 10 years, they still have a lot of problems with confidence, and some of them also has imposter syndrome. Once you start realizing that this is something that's always existing, this is where you realize that you're not alone, and probably you shouldn't care a lot about this feeling because it's normal. Like once you have to acknowledge, okay, the lack of confidence is something that's real and something that anyone experiences, even like staff or senior designers. So for me to think that, oh, okay, once I go to senior or a certain level, I'll be confident. That's not true. That's not true. No matter what level you are, you won't be confident because there's always things that you don't know about. And once you don't know things, that's where you start feeling like I don't have the confidence. But what you can do in order to work towards that confidence is build your context. Really, like getting, once you have like that book where you have all the things that you know, and once you get to these conversations, you'll be easily to like, you'll easily pull out this information or this knowledge and be able to talk about your problem or your solution. Like a lot of this confidence is, you'll only have confidence once you have context. If you don't have context about a certain thing, it's very hard to talk about it. And that's the only way, really, like educating yourself and learning about the problem space, learning about your user and growing that confidence is what makes you feel confident or trust yourself talking about these things. And people would also trust you once you're able to like provide these examples or these learnings that you knew from the past. Because if you say like, oh, this doesn't work, and you're not able to provide the reason why, people won't trust you. And you won't also be able to talk yourself out of it.
Yeah.
Wow. That entire segment just like struck a chord.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for being so open to share this part. Yeah. And it really hits quite deep. And I'm also thinking, right, like you were in a place where you are quite comfortable and quite confident. But you kept pushing yourself to go to a bigger box, to somewhere that is scarier, more unknown. Yeah, and I think that's really quite powerful. Yeah. Actually, why? Why do you do that? Like, what drives you to keep pushing yourself to go further and grow?
I think it comes with my personality as well. Like, I'm a type 7, which is like an Enneagram type 7. So what that means is my type is the type of person who easily gets bored and always wants to like explore things. If I start feeling like I'm not enjoying what I'm doing or I'm not growing, then it really affects how I show up at work, because it really affects like my motivation. Like, if I feel like I'm not challenged or I'm not growing, then that's when I start feeling unhappy. And what drives me is like that growth, because if I'm growing, I'm happy. And a lot of people, their happiness depends on different things, but if I'm growing, that's my happiness. And once I don't stop growing, I'm unhappy. So I don't want an unhappy Justine. So I want to make sure that I'm growing. And a lot of it is also driven from the reason why I moved to Canada. Like, I moved here because I want to learn. Because when I was in the Philippines, it's hard for me to talk more about new things, because we're learning the same things. Like, in order for me to really like teach new things and teach them in a different level, I have to be somewhere that's outside and somewhere where I am surrounded by talented and more like far smarter people than I am. So I could learn something new and bring that back home. And it takes a lot of courage, I think. Whenever I talk about this with my peers, they're like, "You move all the way here for that reason?" Like, I won't be able to do that. And I think it's the courage, because if you're stepping away from your comfort, you're also sacrificing a lot of things. Like, for me, I sacrifice the comfort of my home. Like, I don't know people here. Like, if you imagine it, I moved here October 2019. And then after 6 months, COVID happened.
Yeah.
And everything was remote. Like, imagine me moving here, Canada, I don't know anyone, alone by myself. I have to learn all of the cultural differences. And then 6 months in, you're going to tell me I can't see my peers anymore. I am back at my apartment, home alone, and no one really to get with me. And so, like, it's a huge, like, sacrifice for me if I want to learn. And, you know, I have to be comfortable with discomfort.
And maybe just to touch on, I guess I'm also very curious, as designers, you guys, I guess, would be categorized as creative people, right? I'm just curious, what do you think it means to be, like, in terms of growth or being more creative, to get better or more creative, or to get better at creativity? Is that something, like, if I just give you like a generic person, you could train them or somehow give them a toolkit to be creative? Or is it something like you have to be born with or immersed in an environment that makes you creative? Yeah.
I think a lot of, if you want to grow with your creativity, I think it's really like your opportunity of working on a certain thing. And it's not dependent on where you are or probably like somehow who you're surrounded with. But I think the first thing is like, if you have the opportunity to even express or explore that creativity, like in an agency, you kind of are limited with so many things. And probably it's okay, because if some designers are comfortable with that process. But for me, like, in order for me to really creatively grow, I have to have more flexibility on what I could explore. It could be a certain type of project. For example, if I'm always working on brochure websites, the only thing I'll learn about, or the only muscle that I'll really grow, is making brochure websites. I wouldn't grow outside of making or designing for software. And so the first important thing to me is whether I have the opportunity to actually work on something that's gonna help me express my creativity. And one thing is like working on a product. Like, if you're working on a product, you're expressing so many things. You're expressing usability, you're expressing UX, you're expressing also UI in some level, even if you have a design system. So for me, first, do you have even the opportunity to work on that and express that? And once you have the opportunity, there's no single process, I believe. Like, if you want to grow your creativity muscle, I think every experience has either verse, they all come in different ways, in They all have different starting points. They could have different limitations. But as long as you keep having that experience and getting feedback in some way, you'll creatively grow. And I think it's not something that you can easily that easily presents itself to you. It's something that you have to work towards if you want to be creative, because you have to go the extra mile. Like if you only have the opportunity to work on a brochure, you can easily just look at brochure sites outside and just copy them, copy paste, that's it, call it a day. But if you really want to express your creative muscle, you can go the extra mile and do your research, do different versions. And if you want, you can talk to users and see how they react to it. You can book sessions with your peers and get feedback from them. Really, like if you want to grow your muscle, you have to iterate and you have to do it repeatedly, because it grows. It makes you grow because you already know things that work and that doesn't. And so the next time you won't commit the same mistakes. And I think, again, it comes from the opportunity. If you really even have that opportunity to learn. And if you don't have, then I would say you probably are in the wrong place, or probably you might want to do like a side hustle where you would have that freedom.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. And before I ask one of our last questions, Wong Lee, you have anything else you want to get off your chest?
I think it's a very very interesting energy that Justin you use, like creativity as a muscle. So it's something that you can train, something that you can keep on using, and it becomes stronger.
Exactly.
Yeah. I tend to think of creativity as inborn.
Yeah. I guess we usually think of creativity like something.
You are creative.
You are creative. You know, it's not like you train to be creative. Yeah.
You train to become a creative. Like, it's almost like, it's like food. Okay, I'm gonna relate it to food. you'll never know what a good ramen is unless you eat a lot of ramen, like a lot of ramen. You have to eat like ramen from Japan. You have to eat ramen from everywhere, and that's where you get like a sense of, okay, this is a good ramen. The next time you eat a ramen, you know why it's good, because you'll probably have a lot of like data points or research done what makes a good ramen. And that's the same for design. Like, you basically expose yourself to so many things. It could be a problem, a question, a context, and the more you learn about these things, the easier you can recall why these things don't work and why they don't. So it's like creative muscle, or like a sense of taste almost, that you're building.
Oh, yeah, taste.
Love the ramen energy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Food is the universal language.
I have two questions to end it. One is, I guess you seem like as a designer and doing a lot of UX research and stuff like that, I'm sure you consume content or read or watch videos, YouTube and stuff. Do you have any favorite YouTube channels, or what is the content that you are consuming today to keep yourself, keep that creative muscle strong and learning new things? Yeah. Or even like articles and posts. Yeah.
I think I'm at the stage of my career where a lot of the things that I want to learn is like building my deep thinking muscle. So what that means is like, I want to make sure that if I'm thinking about between radio button or checkbox, I'm able to like really articulate why this works and why this doesn't work. Mm. I'm at the point where I'm also like, I really care about the type of user and how they would specifically use our product. And so a lot of this information are quite niche and they can't be really found online. Like a lot of the online things are very generic, like they're kind of a cookie cutter, almost like why this doesn't work and why this doesn't. It lacks the context of the product usually. It doesn't have the layer of your problem space.
The specificity, yeah.
And so a lot of my learning is actually internal in the company. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is doing something and then putting it out there and receiving peer feedback. Because a lot of the reason why I moved to Shopify is because I know there's a lot of experts here. And so if I'm able to like talk to them and see how they, like what's the difference of their thinking, Like, do they think differently? Do they care about things that I haven't thought about? And that's kind of my learning right now. Like, a lot of the times I find myself, holy shit, I haven't thought of that. Like, I get a sense of what makes a very great designer from a good designer. A lot of them are very thinking deeply about the problem space, and they're able to like really internalize what's going on in the screen and things that you haven't even thought about, they thought about.
Oh, yeah, makes sense. Go ahead. Sorry.
Like, but I think for me, like, if I don't want to like not give any resources, but I think what works for me is also like following designers from Twitter. Like, oh, there's a lot of great design leadership in Twitter, and I usually follow them. And most of them also publish their own article. And that's like a way for me to actually find good stuff online, just following them. And then if they share a good resource and they really recommend it, usually I read the stuff that they're sharing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And yeah, sorry, I have two questions. So one question is, let's imagine like, you know, Justine, Shopify has opened back up and you've gone to the office, had a day of work, and then you come back home, you shut the door, you plunk yourself down on the sofa and you think to yourself, wow, that was a good day, you know? And what would encompass, you know, a good day for you, like in terms of work and life in Shopify?
Yeah. Oh man, that's a deep question, because it's hard to imagine what a good day is in times of COVID. Mm-hmm. Like, COVID has affected a lot of my mental health, and probably a lot of designers and people working in tech are affected by it, that they don't really openly talk about it. Mm-hmm. I hope they openly talk about it, because I struggle a lot with my mental health ever since the pandemic happened. But a good day for me is really a day that doesn't have conflicts that I can't solve, or conflicts that I cannot solve right away. So for example, like, if my good day is more like I have a bunch of meetings, and then I learn from them, there's no roadblockers, nothing that really worries me, I call that a day. Like, I think my contentment is now different. If there's nothing on fire, I'm happy. If there's something on fire, then that worries me, I can't sleep. But a good day is for me is like just going through, surviving your day, really.
That's the simplest way to put it. Yeah. And just to wrap it up, I guess, as someone who, I guess you could call a fairly experienced person in the design space, are there any like, and a lot of our listeners are people, you know, who are from all walks of life in engineering, developers, designers as well. Like, are there any principles of good design that you would leave our listeners with, that you've learned from your experience so far, that they can apply in their, you know, day-to-day lives?
I think... maybe I'll talk about like what I think is what makes a great designer, and probably they could draw what disciplines they wanna make out of it. Mm-hmm. But for me, a great designer is someone who knows about their user very deeply. They are aware of the challenges of their user, and they're able to like flesh it out and tackle that in their mock-ups. Like, and present different ways to solve the problem. I think a lot of the great designers that I know were able to kind of forecast, or almost like think 10 steps ahead and see like, if this solution is shipped, what problems would it cause? And how can we like remove that from the equation? And like, a lot of them are able to predict what this solution, how the solution would affect their users. And that's something that I really like about these great designers, is just the way they think. They think about the future. They think about, once we have this ship, and once this other part of the admin is shipping and this part is shipping, how are they going to work together as a system? So they're very systems thinking and very future thinking as well. And I think the only way for you to be like that is just, again, educating yourself and getting exposure, and surrounding yourself with this like-minded people in order for you to like also grow that muscle, because you have like a baseline of what that's like. A second for me is being a very good storyteller. And it's something that I'm also trying to practice is like, how do I make sure that what I'm talking about makes sense to the type of audience that I'm talking to? Different types of audiences have different levels of context. Some of them, you work closely, and so when you talk about your solution, they don't need to know the nitty-gritty details of your problem. But when you're talking about stakeholders who are not as close to your team, then you have to spend more time like giving them that context in order for them to confidently give you that type of feedback. And you also need to talk about it from your user's lens, because you want to take them into a story and not just like, this is what this thing does. You want to make sure that, how does it make sense to my user's life or my user's workflow, and kind of relate it to that from that lens. And a great designer is able to do that. Like, they're able to talk about it through their user story or through their user's journey and still make that clear to their type of audience despite of different levels. So I'm not sure if that's a discipline, but that's like a good skill to build and something that I also admire from a designer. And I think the third one is like being fun to work with, really. Like if you're not fun to work with, then you'll have problems in your work life. You also don't feel motivated. So first thing, you have to be a fun person. At least
people enjoy
working with you. You have to be a nice person. I don't know, it depends.
Yeah.
But
start with nice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then
if you're
fun
to work
fun.
With. Yeah, so that's it.
And I think that's a great place to end the official part of our podcast. So yeah, thanks for coming on the show, Justine.
Thank you so much.
If you like what you heard, please help us subscribe, rate, and review. Let us know what you think and tell us who else you want
you
on
can
the
go
pod.
To risepeoplepodcast.com, where you can find every episode of this podcast complete with transcripts and show notes. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next week.